Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Mike Williams, world-renowned computing pioneer, past president in 2007 of the IEEE Computer Society, and professor emeritus at the University of Calgary. Mike, you bring a lifetime of acknowledged computing, educational, and historical leadership to our audience. Considering your heavy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Stephen.
So, Mike, what initially triggered your interest in computing?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I didn't have much money. In fact, I had no money at all. But I had a friend from high school who actually had a car, and he was able to drive me to and from the university every day. And in the rides, he would often talk about the fact that the university was getting a new computer, or getting a computer, actually, because this was early days. And one day, he didn't show up for our usual ride home, so I went looking for him. And he had said that the university was short of space, and so this new computer was going to be installed in the staff women's washroom. And I managed to find that easy enough, and sure enough, there he was, sitting at the console of this computer. And I asked him what he was doing, and he started explaining, and I think I got hooked from that point on.
Well, that's an interesting story. So you've had a long interest in this field.
Yes, that was probably 1960, so it's been now 48 years, I suppose.
Can you profile your areas of research early in your career?
Well, after I got interested in computing, I met the mathematician who had arranged for the computer to come to the University of Calgary. And it was a very small machine, but it was quite an interesting device. He offered a number of undergraduates jobs in the summer to help him with programming and things of that nature. So I applied for and was lucky enough to get one of them. And just at that time, he had been approached by the university registrar saying that would this newfangled machine help him in creating an exam timetable so that he could minimize the number of students who had to write two exams at one time and thus cause problems, of course. And the head of department, well, he wasn't head of department then, but his name was John Peck. And he asked me to look into the problem, and I can remember a session in his office when he was describing this, and he described an area of mathematics known as graph theory and how coloring of these graphs might actually help in producing an exam timetable. And at that point, I got very interested in this particular branch of mathematics and how computers might actually help to solve what was otherwise an intractable problem. And in the space of a summer and perhaps a few months afterwards, I managed to get a computer program going that would actually not do an optimal job, but would actually do a workable solution to the registrar's problem. And that got me interested in using computers for this kind of work, which developed into things in later in my career.
So you had this sort of very rich history at the University of Calgary. What roles did you undertake while at the university, and can you share lessons from each of these roles?
Well, after I did my graduate work, I came back to the University of Calgary as a staff member, and was a very junior staff member. The mathematics department was just beginning to offer some courses in what we would now call computer science. And there were three or four of us who were basically designated to teach these courses. And after the first year, the mathematics department had grown considerably. It was one of the largest departments in the university and was becoming unwieldy to administer. So they decided that they would split this apart into various divisions, and there was a division of pure mathematics, applied mathematics, statistics, and computer science. And I was busy working in my office at one point and got a note from the dean saying, would I come and see him? And he said that he wanted me to chair this new division of computer science. And this struck me as very odd because I was a very junior, in fact, the junior member of staff, and there were senior people who would have done a much better job than I. But for some reason or other, the dean had not liked them or fell afoul of them in some way or other. And he looked at me and he said, you have a choice. You can either become chair of this division of computer science or you can hand in your resignation. And I didn't know that at the time that he couldn't do that, but I took that as a bit of a challenge and said, well, sure, of course I'll do it. So I had an administrative appointment here at the university, albeit a junior one, very early on in my career. That led to all sorts of interesting experiences, and eventually took other administrative jobs as well as my teaching. I became basically what was the dean of students. And that was one of the best jobs I think I ever had. For about 4 years, I was in charge of reviewing student programs and counseling students and having to throw students out when they weren't doing a good job and to encourage students who were doing good jobs and create other programs for them. If a student wanted to do a particular strange program and I thought it was all right, my signature was as good as God, I could just say, yes, go ahead and do it. And I really enjoyed that particular kind of job, helping out students. There were, of course, some nasty times when you had to tell a student that he'd been given every chance in the world and now there was the time for him to pack his bags and leave. But it was an interesting position. The other thing I liked was actually the interaction with my own students, and particularly teaching. I'm enough of a ham that I love to go into the classroom and teach a unified course in a particular subject. And I also would keep an open door so that students could drop in any time, and quite a number of them did. And we used to have some very interesting interaction, sometimes late into the evening, often ending up in a Chinese restaurant at 2 a.m. or something like that. So I very much enjoyed those particular undertakings.
So in terms of lessons, I'm just thinking that perhaps the dean spotted this tremendous talent that you have and provided an opportunity and gave you a bit of a catalyst to sort of flower that opportunity. And in terms of your students, the fact that you kept this open door policy to support engagement and even drive that kind of passion with students. Are those some of those lessons?
Well, I suppose so. I think often the choices were forced. I don't think the dean had too many other people to turn to when he asked me to become chair of the division. But, it might well have been that he could see I had some potential in that regard.
Well, now you went on to Glasgow, and what was the catalyst for your interest in the history of computing?
Well, I was doing graduate work at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, and it was one of the very first computer science departments in the world. It has, about 2 years ago, celebrated its 50th anniversary, so it was formed before virtually any others. It was very small, of course. And the professor and head of the department had previously been working in a consulting firm in London. That's relevant because after a couple of years, I was working one Sunday afternoon in my office in an old converted house that the university had taken over. And getting tired, I thought I would go and brew a cup of tea. So I went down into what was left of the kitchen in this old house and plugged in the kettle to have a cup of tea. And while I was waiting for the kettle to boil, I looked around and I realized that although I'd seen the cupboards in this old kitchen many times, they were full of our cups and things of that nature, I'd never actually looked in the cupboards underneath the counter. So just out of curiosity, I opened one of the doors, and they were full of books. And it turns out that our professor had somehow or other acquired the library of the people that he worked with in London. and had brought this library to Glasgow. And there was a book in there written by Charles Babbage, a very early computer pioneer, pre-electronic days. This was in the middle of the 1800s. And I started flipping through this. I'd heard the name but knew nothing about him. And I think the kettle was boiling away for quite some time before I realized it, because I just got very interested in this book and the sort of things that Charles Babbage was trying to do. And that was basically the beginning of my interest in the history of computing, purely by accident.
Well, you've made some or many remarkable contributions. Now, how did you come to be at the National Museum of American History, and can you describe your contributions there?
Well, that museum is part of the Smithsonian, and they had had a very early exhibit on computing. They had, for example, von Neumann's first machine at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and a few other quite early computers. But it had been there for some time. This was in the probably about 1980, and they decided that what they had to do was refresh this exhibit and start over again to create a proper exhibit on the then-developing information age. And, of course, they were looking around for some help, and one of their advisors happened to know of me, and so I got this phone call one day saying, why don't you come down here and talk to us for a bit? So I was happy to oblige, and in the end they sort of said, you know, could you arrange with your university for a leave of absence and come and work for 4 months just helping us get the ideas right and look over what artifacts we have and see how we could arrange these in a proper story. And that led to longer and longer episodes at the Smithsonian. I actually left before the exhibit was set up, simply because there were some personal problems at home with my parents, who had both been in nursing homes and things. So I didn't get to see the end of it, but I made quite a number of contributions at the beginning of the exhibit. And that exhibit has lasted for a good 25 years now, and it has just closed because they're about to refresh it again.
That's a remarkable time, and I know you've also spent notable moments as the head curator at the Computer History Museum. Can you share some of these?
Oh, that was a very fun time in my life. Computer History Museum is in Silicon Valley in California. The museum had started in Boston many years ago, but it soon ran into financial and other problems. And a group of people in California who were interested in creating a museum in Silicon Valley actually acquired all the exhibits and artifacts that had been in this museum in Boston. They didn't have a building or anything. They just had old, leaky warehouses that were on a ex-military airfield. So they asked me if I would be interested in coming down and helping them sort of sort this out. And I leapt at the chance, because here was a chance to get in at the beginning of things. It was a interesting time. We had to try and create a new building, and we talked with architects, and they were in the middle of creating plans for a new building for us when the dot-com bust happened, and all sorts of industrial firms were pulling back and leaving buildings empty in Silicon Valley. So through that fortuitous circumstance, we acquired an extremely nice, very modern building of 120,000 square feet that we proceeded to convert into a museum. And the next problem was, of course, we had to try and move the artifacts that we had. Now, this is the world's largest collection of computing artifacts. If you take everything in the Smithsonian, everything in the London Science Museum, everything in the Deutsches Museum in Germany, and a few others, combine them all together, this collection in California is still much larger. And it's everything from tiny wee microchips to various Cray supercomputers that weighed about 9 tons. and these were all jammed into a number of these old leaky warehouses. So trying to organize the movement of this collection of artifacts into the new building and arrange them in some sort of way so that we could at least tell a preliminary story was a very interesting task, and quite frankly, it's one I don't ever want to repeat. It was very hard work. I think in the end there were something like 38 of the largest moving vans arrived at the new site full of stuff, and it all had to be sorted and cataloged and cleaned, and it was a four-month process just to do the move, let alone do all the cataloging and things of that nature. That was a really interesting part. And, of course, setting up the very first exhibit was a challenge as well under those circumstances.
You know, you also worked as the editor-in-chief for the journal The Annals of the History of Computing. Can you share some insights on that time as well?
Well, I started that again because I happened to know somebody who was the editor at the time. And he asked me to write a little write-up about a conference that was being held, one of the first history sessions. And I guess I must have done a reasonable job because he then asked me to do something else. And before long, I got a phone call saying that would I join the editorial board and be his assistant? Well, I thought that was a good idea, but little did I know that the journal at the time was in dire straits. It had nothing in the pipeline to be published. It was already late with an issue. So it was, again, like starting up something new. The early days of that journal were basically the computer pioneers discussing their own work. And the reason for founding the journal was that a lot of these stories were being lost as these people were dying off, particularly the inside story, you know, the little interesting anecdotes and things. And it has now shifted, and it's shifted because there's now a thriving community of technical historians who are writing historical papers for publishing in that journal, and also because, unfortunately, the first generation of pioneers are now largely dead. But it certainly served to preserve some of the stories of the creation of this interesting device and how it was used in the early days. And it's now quite thriving. It has a long waiting list for things to be published, and a very lively group of both readers, subscribers, and authors. That was an interesting thing to work on.
So we're going to sort of keep that in mind. I'm going to ask a question about some of these stories a little bit later on in this interview, so I just want to keep that as a thought as we go on here. I just want to do a bit of a shift. You know, you took on as chairman of the IEEE History Committee. Can you talk about some of the key initiatives there?
Well, the History Committee has been in existence for a long time in the IEEE. Just in case people don't realize that the IEEE is the world's largest professional society. It's got over now almost 400,000 members of various engineering professions and computing professions around the world. So it's big enough that it can use some of its resources to do things like history. And I happen to have known the executive director of the History Center. He had a staff of about three people in those days, and was, of course, chartered by the IEEE to look into the history of everything from power engineering to antennas and signal propagation to computers, covering the whole gamut of electrical engineering. One of the things they did was to have a series of milestones. The first electrical power generation plant in a vicinity, and things of that nature, things that had been instrumental in the development of technology in the electrical engineering field. and they would place a suitably decent plaque on the site. One of the things that I did, I suppose, was to broaden it out from power engineering and things of this nature so that it included slightly more modern things. That would be development of various computing facilities, things like the Canadian first Canadian satellite for radio communication, the Alouette satellites, things of this nature. And we managed to erect plaques so that the general public, as they're passing, can at least see that there's a historic site in the neighborhood, and that might perhaps twig their interest in investigating these things slightly further. And, of course, there was all sorts of administrative tasks, the simple day-to-day things of creating budgets, trying to support the staff by being their volunteer voice at the IEEE meetings and things of that nature. So it was an interesting job, and you occasionally got a few interesting bits and pieces of things done.
You know, from your just simply remarkable lifetime of research in the history of computing, which contributions can you share as particularly meaningful to you? And what I mean by that, that resonated with you personally?
Well, I think what I enjoyed most about the history of computing was the people. And this included not only the early computer pioneers, but people like Charles Babbage, Leibniz back in the 1600s, and going back as far as about 4,000 years ago, the scribes in Egypt that left records of how they actually did computation. It's the stories of these people rather than the actual physical things they created that I found by far the most interesting. A lot of them, of course, people like this Egyptian scribe, very little is known about him personally, but others like Leibniz in the 1600s or Napier or people of that nature, a lot is known about their lives, and they led remarkably interesting lives. And they were extremely interesting individuals. Leibniz was one of the greatest intellects in the last 1,000 years, and yet as he grew older, he became very covetous of money and honors and literally drove his friends away to the point where when this man died, he was extremely well known throughout all of Europe, lauded in fields from philosophy to science to diplomacy, and yet only one man came to his funeral, and that was his private secretary. And it seems very interesting to me that somebody could be so hated for his personal life that they just ignored all his tremendous contributions, and one person showed up at his funeral. I just find that fascinating. And there's similar stories about many of these people.
Well, that's quite a remarkable story, that you're sort of the contrast. I find that quite interesting. You know, you're just the amazing computing pioneer, and you've participated in the publishing of 11 books and 92 articles, 58 technical reviews, 72 invited lectures, and then you've been involved in creation of 10 different radio, television, and museum productions, and plus much, much more. Which, let's say, two or three specific events or personal interactions stand out for you, and can you provide the context?
Well, like anybody else, I never set out to do interesting things. I set out to do things that were just fascinating to me. And some of these turned out to be fascinating to other people as well. One of the things that has been most remarkable to my thought, anyway, is perhaps the second book I wrote. And I needed some notes to teach a course. I had established a course in the history of computing, And after a couple of years of handing out rough notes to students, I took a leave of absence from the university and for 6 months just sat down and wrote and created basically a textbook on the subject. And that textbook was picked up by a number of people and was available in the usual sort of stores and whatnot. And that has led to quite a number of very remarkable things as far as I'm concerned. One of which was that the CDC picked it up, and they have a program at night called Ideas. And they asked me if I would come to Toronto and record an hour session just talking about the history of computing. And that I found fascinating because I had never been involved in media things before. And I was greatly impressed at just how much work went into creating an hour radio show and how hard these individuals actually worked. That and various other things led to a meeting of all sorts of interesting, again, people, computer pioneers, because as I was trying to document the history of computing, I would deliberately go out and try and meet the people who had done it and try and find out their motivations and their contributions in various ways. And this led to me meeting such eminent pioneers as Conrad Zuse and Wilkes in Cambridge, and a lot in Canada. There's Kelly Gottlieb in Toronto, various other people at the University of Toronto. There was another one at the University of Saskatoon named Andrew Donald Booth. And all of these people just led fascinating lives. They were desperate to try and develop computing in some way or other, and each of them approached it differently. They often had almost no resources, and just the effort that they had to make to get things started was a wonderful lesson in overcoming all sorts of problems for me.
You know, you mentioned Kelly Gottlieb. It's interesting that I think it was last year that he retired from teaching. So
yeah, he's been around since, well, I think he started teaching in the late 40s, and he's been around all this time. He's still going strong and still a very, very interesting man.
Yeah, in fact, he chairs some of those awards committees, I think, with the ACM.
So. Oh, yes, he's been involved with the ACM since it first started. But, you know, there was a lot of other people that helped out as well. Kelly was one of the leaders in Canada, of course, but there are many others, the sort of unsung heroes that soldiered away in the background. There's people like Ian Sharp, who established IP Sharp and Associates, one of the most successful consulting companies in Canada. Ian, of course, has been retired for a long time now. But there's a lot of very interesting, very influential people in Canada.
And you also have had the opportunity to meet some of the leaders in industry as well.
Yes, and I've been quite fortunate in that. And certainly this last year, as you indicated, in 2007, I was president of the IEEE Computer Society and had to, as part of the job, go around to all sorts of conferences and other situations to present awards and do the sorts of things that a president of a society does. And that got me to the chance of meeting not only industrial leaders here, but industrial leaders in China and Korea and Japan and even as far-flung as Bulgaria. It was a very, very rewarding experience.
Mike, you know, we talked about your passion for teaching and how you enjoyed that time so much, and, you know, you received the award for excellence for consistently outstanding contribution in teaching. Can you share some lessons from this time or from this distinguished career?
Well, first of all, I love teaching. I remember my mother, to get rid of me on Saturdays, would give me what little money she could spare and send me out to the local movie theater. And she would say when I came back, I would follow her around the house trying to tell her every single thing about the movie I saw, the plot and the actors and the people. And so I was a sort of natural explainer right from my earliest days. So it was fairly natural that I should gravitate into a teaching kind of position. But I have seen a lot of teachers in a lot of different situations. And some teachers are beloved of the students because they come and they tell interesting stories, but they seem to have an inability to coordinate a year-long course. And they tend to go off on sidetracks. I've had many students complain to me about various people who are very interesting in what they say, but it's such a random collection of thoughts that they really can't gain much of a cohesive idea of the subject. And so I prided myself on always being prepared for a class. I never left anything to chance. I always had notes. And although I would deviate onto a sidetrack, I would always find my way back to the main topic before the class was over. And I think that's an absolute necessity for a teacher that's going to do their good job. You have to be prepared. You can't just walk in and start talking and hope that you will say something of interest to the students. You have to have a plan. You have to have the examples all prepared. You have to have everything laid out rather than just leaving it to chance and hoping that you can wing it. So that, I think, is the big lesson that I learned, and I learned that very early on in my career.
Mike, you have so many remarkable achievements in your life, and I know you received the C.C. Gottlieb Award, and you also have a Doctor of Science degree. Can you provide some background on those accomplishments?
Well, the Gottlieb Award was something given by KIPS, the Canadian Information Processing Society. I never thought that I would be given any of these things. Each of them has come as a very distinct surprise. But at one time, I was very active within KIPS, and particularly having submitted a number of articles, probably about 20 or 30, I should think, maybe even more than that, on the history of computing. And they published one short thing in each of their magazines that went out to the members. This was a long time ago. And I suddenly got phoned up one day and said that for all my work in this effort, they were going to give me the Gottlieb Award. And that came, as I say, as a surprise. What came as an even bigger surprise was that it was to be presented at their national meeting. And their national meeting that year, the Canadian Prime Minister showed up, and it was him who presented me with the award. So that was another interesting surprise, the first time I've ever met a politician of that sort of magnitude. And again, the Doctor of Science degree, honorary degree, was a real surprise. I just got this letter one day, and I thought it had a very ordinary-looking envelope. In fact, there was a sticky label on the front where my address had been typed, and I thought, oh, it's a begging letter for money or something like that. And I was about to throw it out when I thought I'd better open it, and I just about dropped onto the floor when it said that the Senate had devoted me an honorary Doctor of Science degree. And that was basically because of a lifetime of contributions to the history of computing and trying to document it.
Well, a Doctor of Science degree is a rare achievement, so I really commend you on these amazing accomplishments like the Gottlieb Award and the Doctor of Science degree award. So.
Oh, thank you. I think there are many, many others that deserve these awards. I was suitably humbled to receive them. I certainly never expected that I would ever get either one. They both came as tremendous surprises.
Mike, you are so eloquent, and I know we met in 2006 at a summit that was held with the large societies, and then subsequently in 2007 you became president of the IEEE CS. What compelling tips can you share from this time as president? I know it was an interesting time for you.
Oh, very interesting indeed. I think the most succinct way I can put it is things never go as you plan. You start off with the idea in a job like that that, yeah, you can create this initiative, you can do this to help a certain area, you can have all sorts of plans, and then things invariably go wrong. The Computer Society had been financially quite well off, and the year before I became president, for the first time in its history, it ran a deficit. It's got a very large budget, but this was still a deficit of something like $5 million. And so instead of all these wonderful, grandiose plans, I had to work hard to try and to correct all the financial problems that had led to this deficit. And I'm quite proud to say that, in fact, at the end of my year as president, we ran just over $1 million surplus in the budget. But there's still lots of things that need to be done, of course. But that was a lesson in trying to look at a large organization, see where the organization was perhaps as, not as efficient as it could be, to actually sort out what our real priorities were and to drop things that, that weren't a first priority things in order to get our financial situation back in order. It was certainly a lot of hard work, and I think the major lesson I took away from that is that if you take a job of that nature, and of course it's a volunteer job, you've got to be interested in people, because it's people that actually do the work. You don't do the work yourself. You try and encourage others to do it. And sometimes you're successful and sometimes you're not. And in a volunteer situation like that, if somebody isn't being successful, it's very difficult to fire a volunteer. So you have to figure out other ways of accomplishing your goals if somebody isn't actually managing their end of things. All of these things are just very interesting learning experiences, and unfortunately, once you've learned them, you can't go back and do the job again.
Yeah, it's a remarkable time in the sense that you have this period where you get all of this experience and then your term ends.
That's right. And of course, you're still involved in these organizations and other things, but you're not as involved because there's a new president and there's a new group of people who are trying to implement their plans and goals, and they're obviously going to find frustrating circumstances the same way I did.
Well, that's interesting. This kind of reminds me of a story. I had a conversation with Bill Miller, and he's a serial entrepreneur, and he's in the Silicon Hall of Fame for all of his contributions, and he set up the computing program at Stanford and so on. And from his corporate experience, he says that if you can run a volunteer organization, you can run any corporation.
Yes, I think I probably agree with him on that. Volunteer organizations are often much more difficult. The old expression of trying to herd cats comes to mind.
Right, stray cats, right. You know, there's this UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, and they have their Professional Practice Partnership Program, which received full ratification at a General Assembly in August of 2007. And then they held their first implementation meeting in Montreal in October. And this literally marks an inflection point and speaks to IT as a recognized profession with global standards, profession-based code of ethics, and widely adopted professional certification. All of this happening in 2009. Can you comment on IFIP and this IP3 program, this International Professional Practice Program, and then global certification and professionalism and what this means?
Well, as you say, IFIP was a very early organization. I think the first attempts were about 1958 under the auspices of UNESCO to try and get some kind of international cooperation in computing. And I, of course, ICIP has grown and in some ways shrunk because various national societies have become much more prominent, KIPPS in Canada and the ACM and the IEEE Computer Society in the USA and British Computer Society and things. And so they've been taking some of the load off of ICIP. But ICIP is still a very interesting organization with some interesting global reach. And this certification program is one of a number of certifications that are going. As an industry matures, you find that there's all sorts of educational things established, both university and college and private schools and things to try and educate people so that they can take part in jobs in that industry. And what's happening now is that people will apply for jobs, say, and the employers find it very difficult to know what abilities this particular individual may or may not have. And so, as with other industries, the various groups have set up certification programs so that people can take these certifications and that way have some sort of standard that they can compare themselves against or advertise themselves for jobs and various other items. So there's a lot of need for certification. It certainly helps out industry. But there's many different kinds of certification. There's to certify that you are knowledgeable about and capable of leading a huge software project, like a software engineer. That's one thing. To be certified as a technician to go and install Windows on a computer is something entirely different. And now they're beginning to recognize and sort out the different kinds of certification that are needed. And different national groups, as well as ICIP, are starting to offer these different kinds of certification and to bring not only people who classify themselves as software professionals, but class of IT professionals that keep the day-to-day business of computing running in an industry or business to get them some sort of international recognition, some international standards, and as you say, things like code of ethics, which is actually quite important in a computing industry, because if you don't have a good ethical sense, you can do incredible amounts of harm. So I think that the industry is now maturing to the point where these certifications are both necessary and desirable. And I hope that this will continue to develop along this, the line that has just now been started.
It's a remarkable time in that it does reflect an historical point in terms of having a global professionalism program. So I think it's very interesting in terms of where it's building out. You know, earlier we talked about, or you shared this idea that, you know, you meet various people and you've encountered interesting sort of situations. So I'm going to kind of reach now into sort of your wisdom, and if you could share some stories centered around themes like something that was amusing or surprising, inspirational, perhaps disruptive or historical, and all the people that you met, all the different kinds of contributions that you made. Some additional interesting stories that will kind of give the audience a feel for some of the things that you've done or some of the people that you've met.
Okay. There's so many. Let's start with amusing. There's certainly a lot of amusing things that have happened to me or stories that I've heard. One that sticks in my mind just at the moment, there was a very, very early computer pioneer named Howard Aiken at Harvard University. And Howard unfortunately died many years ago. But a few years back, I happened to meet his widow. And we had supper together. And I was asking her, the usual questions about Howard and about her life and the kinds of things that had happened. And she related the story that after Howard retired, they had moved to Florida. And Howard always had an interest in cats, and so he decided that he was going to keep cats. But Howard never did anything by halves. And so the two cats that he acquired, one was a cougar and the other was a jaguar. And these were house cats. Now, I think this is a foolish thing to have done, but she said it worked out fairly well. These huge cats prowled around the house, and they had fenced enclosures, of course, for them. And eventually the cougar died, but the jaguar lived to quite a ripe old age. And after Howard was dead, she said she had a problem in the kitchen where the kitchen sink had stopped up. And she called the plumber. Now, she said, what you have to realize is that this kitchen sink faced a wall. Often kitchen sinks are placed where you can look out the window as you're doing work. But this one faced a wall. And so she had mounted quite a large mirror on the wall so that she wasn't just looking at a blank wall all the time. And the jaguar was getting quite old and was slightly arthritic. And so it liked to go and curl up in nice warm places. And one of the warmest places was on top of the big fridge that they had. And she said the plumber came, and she brought him into the house. And he took one look at the sink and said, oh, yes, I can fix that, and was busy trying to do that when he happened to look up into this mirror. And, of course, this cat, seeing that something new and interesting was going on, had stood up and was basically peering over his shoulder from just a few feet behind him in the kitchen. And he saw this in the mirror. She said she heard this loud scream and saw a streak running through the house and out the front door. And she said, you know, I still have his box of tools. He never came back.
Yeah, that's a really funny story. How about something surprising?
Oh, surprising. Well, there have been a lot of surprising things, but I think to get a little more serious for the moment, the surprising thing to me is how the interest in the history of computing and the history of technology in general has grown. When I first started this, I was not taken seriously by anybody. I remember one of my colleagues say, why are you playing with history? That's what you do after you retire. And now it's an accepted discipline, certainly in academia. There are a lot of people doing PhDs in universities in the history of computing. There are a number of different publications. There's all sorts of books, both in the history of mathematics and the history of computing, that you can buy, not even specialized historical books, but ones that are basically designed for the general public who are interested in such things. Museums are springing up. I think that's the most surprising thing to me, that it actually has grown to become an accepted discipline.
And then on the inspirational front?
Oh, it's probably the people, I would think. One of the two inspiring things, I think. I can remember a high school teacher. Now, I came from a sort of lower middle class family that was always in financial difficulty. There was never any money to do much of anything. And I had this high school teacher in chemistry named Ernie Elkins. And I think Ernie saw some potential for me or something, because nobody in my family had ever gone to university or anything like that. And he kept talking to me about, possibility of going to university. And it was simply because I admired Ernie that I actually started university and started studying chemistry, because he was our chemistry teacher. But he did some fundamental things that were small, but they got my attention. I can remember when the final exams were coming up, he said, you don't work hard enough. You will never get grades that will allow you to go to university. And I said, "You want to bet?" And he said, "I will give you a dollar if you can, you know, get grades good enough in these exams to actually gain university entrance." And a dollar wasn't much. It was more then than it is now. But that inspired me to just, you know, work as hard as I possibly could, and Ernie paid off the dollar. And even after I had a PhD and came back to Calgary to the university, I remember Ernie, who was retired by that time, phoned me up and said he'd heard through the grapevine that I was back, and we went out and had lunch together. And he was just a nice guy and able to take some kid who had no family history of university or anything like that for higher education. I think my father had about a grade 8 education, and inspire me to go on. And another individual that I've come across is a man named Irwin Tomash in the United States. And he made a lot of money in the computer business, eventually retired and sold the business. And he does an awful lot of things. He could take his money and just live the most comfortable jet-setting life. But rather than do that, he has established fellowships for graduate work in the history of computing. And I think it must be approaching 30 students that he's put through their graduate programs at various universities around the world. And he does it all basically on the quiet. He and his wife are just the most wonderful, generous people. They're an inspiration to know and to see somebody who has done remarkably good things in their life.
You know, and would you then have two additional stories, let's say one involving something that's disruptive and then also historical?
Oh, I can certainly have a disruptive one. And this was a grand lesson in 2007 when I was president of the Computer Society. There's another group in the IEEE that's headquartered in Washington, D.C., as we were. And they were losing the lease on their office building. And so the year previous, in 2006, their head person came to me and said, "You know, we've discussed on and off for years that we should perhaps share office space. And you have this wonderful building on Massachusetts Avenue, which is right in the middle of the Embassy Row in Washington. Very prestigious location." And he said, "You know, you're not occupying all the square footage of it. You know, do you think that we could arrange something so that we could share office space and perhaps it'd be a win-win situation?" And I thought, this is good. We should try and help out our colleagues in various ways. So we set about trying to do that. And, of course, after a lot of investigation, we thought that we would have to make some structural alterations to the buildings in order to make this thing possible. But we didn't want to knock down a wall that was supporting the building and things like that. So, of course, we called in the architects and the engineers. And I was quite happily working on various long-range projects and things for my presidency, when I got this interesting phone call that said they had just received the report from the engineers, and there were various structural problems with the building that basically involved it being condemned, and that would I please arrange to get all our staff out of that building in the next week somewhere else. So it wasn't that, you know, we could help our colleagues by them moving in with us. We had to go and shoehorn ourselves in with them in very uncomfortable situations. And then we had to go through all sorts of other planning situations, trying to say, do we bulldoze down this building and erect something else, or do we just carry on in renting office space and sell a building? But it absorbed literally months of effort. So it disrupted the grand plans I had for the presidency. Very difficult time for everybody.
And then finally, on the historical front, you must have a number of interesting stories there, at least one.
Oh, well, there's all the interesting stories about people and things like that. Just one quick one about people. I've already told you about Leibniz, but Somebody who was alive just prior to Leibniz, he lived in the late 15 and very, very early 1600s, was a man named John Napier. Lived in Scotland, and he was the inventor of logarithms. There were other people who were simultaneously creating them, but John Napier was the first to actually publish these things. And Napier is always lauded as being the wonderful mathematician, you know, created logarithms, which was a very, very fundamental advance, one of the most fundamental advances in mathematics and computation. But what is seldom recognized is mathematics was just a hobby for him. He was a landowner, a Scottish laird, as they call it. He had to administer huge estates. He had the power of life and death over the people living on his estates. He believed fervently in witchcraft. He even made pacts with his neighbors to use witchcraft to find buried treasure. And he was also involved in the Reformation in Scotland. The Reformation in Scotland was quite a violent affair, and people took very hardline sides. And John Napier was on the Protestant side, and he was absolutely convinced that the Pope was the devil incarnate, and anybody who was a Roman Catholic was destined to go straight to hell and things like that. And he actually wrote another book called The Complete Revelation of St. John the Divine, which was a thinly disguised diatribe against anything that was Roman Catholic. And that was his pride and joy. He thought he would be forever famous. It was translated into 8 languages and published widely long before any of his mathematics was even recognized. And so, you know, people aren't always quite what they seem to be on the surface. And that's what fascinates me about the history of this subject.
You know, I really enjoyed those stories involving these different areas and, you know, whether they're amusing or surprising, inspirational, disruptive, or historical. Just, you know, it's been a fascinating journey.
Well, yes. It's been fascinating for me, that's for sure.
Well, now we're going to turn this around. We're at the close of this interview, and normally what I do here at the very end is I'm going to say, if you were being the interviewer and you know, rather than the interviewee, what kinds of questions would you ask of yourself, and then how would you answer them?
Oh, that's difficult. I think many of the questions you've asked me would rank high. I have done quite a few interviews, but they have always been on the side of me interviewing some historical figure, and usually historical figure in computing. And so most of them were about the technical contributions that these people made. And I always wanted to try and find something interesting about their background, wondering how they got into this position. So I would often ask things about family background and early education and things, but we've covered parts of that ourselves. The other thing was perhaps that would be revealing would be hardships. For example, I remember interviewing Ian Sharp of IP Sharp and Associates, and basically, the whole team was, had been developing a computer in Toronto in the early days, had been fired when the parent company Ferranti in England decided to get out of that particular business in Canada. And they went through a lot of hardships, and Ian decided that he wanted to fight for the people who were there, and so went and tried to set up this consulting business and hire as many of them as he could, because they were all having hardships too. And, you know, he made a success out of it, but it was a really hard time for him. Fortunately, in my life, I've never had real hardships. I've had all sorts of, you know, personal and family situations and things which were disturbing like everybody else does. But there has never been an absolute hardship crisis, and I think I've been very fortunate about that, but you always learn from these things, even if you do have them. So I guess that's two things, and I'm not sure I can figure out two other questions. I've got two other things that come to mind, though. If people ask me, as they sometimes do, you know, what can I do to advance my career? Well, my answer is volunteer for any and all opportunities that come around to you. If you volunteer to do things, you meet all sorts of other interesting people, which can then lead to other things. And it certainly takes time. It can be disruptive of family life if you're getting to volunteer to do all sorts of things. You know, if you volunteer for a couple of small things when you're young, you can volunteer for more as the family matures and, you know, children leave home and whatnot, then you have a bit more time, and particularly if you have an understanding spouse who realizes this is an important part of your life. Volunteering to do absolutely anything and saying yes almost every time that it comes, the opportunity, but then actually doing things, not just saying yes and then sitting back and doing nothing, can really lead to an advancement in careers. The other thing that always amazes me is people will talk about what you have done, but nobody ever accomplishes anything alone. You don't work in a vacuum. In order to accomplish anything at all, you have to collaborate, both with staff and with other volunteers, as well as friends and colleagues. And the biggest thing is you have to treat them well if you want to be treated well yourself, even in small things. I have seen all sorts of people who come to the support staff at a university or support staff in a situation at the museums or something else, and basically demand, you know, do this, do that. These people are not your servants. They are there to help, and they are willing to help, but they have to be treated politely. And if you are polite, they will be polite back to you, and I've found over the years that if you're polite to them and develop a reputation for that, they will work hard for you, rather than just say, oh, Lordy, he's, you know, somebody's demanding this and demanding that, and they put it aside until later sometime. I've found that if I ask somebody to do something and I have been polite and done favors for them in the past, then they're more than happy to do it for me. So I think that's something that really helps to get along in, not only in your career, but in your life as well.
Well, those are some fascinating questions and fascinating responses. Mike, you know, I've really enjoyed this interview with you. You have such a rich background. You made so many remarkable historical contributions that are sort of contributed to the fabric of this planet. And
well, I'm not quite in that category, perhaps, but you know, I appreciate you saying so.
Well, you know, we're going to continue to follow your significant contributions and that are literally shaping our world, our society, our profession and education and computing, and I sincerely thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and deep insights with our audience.
Well, you're more than welcome, Stephen. It's been a pleasure for me.